morning and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As always, our conversations include you. And if you'd like to join us anytime during the program, the phone lines are open. 941-3689. If you call us from Oahu, that's the number to use. 941-3689. And from the neighbor islands or anywhere else, if you're listening to the live stream, 877-941-3689. Can you imagine going to jail for a crime you didn't commit? For most of us, that would be an ultimate nightmare. In the past 20 years, it has happened at least 311 times. How do we know? That's the number of wrongly convicted people exonerated through the Innocence Project through DNA evidence. Law professor Barry Sheck co-founded the organization at Yeshiva University's Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law, where he teaches with colleague and co-director Peter Neufeld. Barry Sheck is in Hawaii for the American Psychological Association Conference, where he was this morning's keynote speaker. Virginia Hench teaches at UH William S. Richardson School of Law. She's been a professor since 1993, and she is the director of the Hawaii Innocence Project. Also joining us is Dave Hamer. He is a professor at UH as well, though in the Johnny Burns School of Medicine. He spent the last 20 years working with DNA markers in population studies and is the DNA consultant for the Hawaii chapter of the Innocence Project, as he has done for the last 7 years. And of course, again, you're here too. The phone lines are open, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Tonight, we're talking about the Innocence Project. Thanks to all of you for coming. And you've all had long days, I know. You, Barry, we talked this morning on the conversation.
Yes.
And I want to pick up some of the conversation that we began to speak about, looking at, first of all, why did you decide 21 years ago that we needed something called the Innocence Project?
Well, it was sort of an accident that Peter Neufeld and I got a case from our old public defender's office of an individual who was in the Bronx. He was convicted of having attacked a couple that was engaged in what they call an afternoon delight in a Bronx motel. But there were 17 alibi witnesses that he was at a prayer meeting. And so it was 17 alibi witnesses at a prayer meeting versus 3 eyewitnesses. And the person who eventually wound up running the New York Medical Examiner's Office DNA project after 9/11, Dr. Robert Shaler, had just left for a brief period to a new DNA company called LifeCodes that was trying to get in the market. And so he said, why don't we do a test in this case, because it was a sexual assault, they couldn't get a result. And we wound up proving this fellow, Marion Coakley, innocent the old-fashioned way. We found a palm print on the rearview mirror of a car and other evidence showing that he was innocent, and the case was dismissed. But we realized right away that this was going to be revolutionary. So we asked some scientists to come to the law school, and we held the first forum ever in like 1988 on DNA and its potential to change forensic science. And then somebody in that forum, again from the Bronx Public Defender's Office, said, I have a case. They're trying to introduce the DNA into evidence to show that blood on a watch is, number one, not the defendant's blood, right? And number two, comes from this victim. And you guys seem very interested, so why don't you do this hearing for me? So we got involved in the hearing, and just on the admissibility of it, because we sensed there was something wrong. There were these competing companies, and they hadn't published in peer-reviewed journals, and this technology shouldn't work, but, you know, should work, but it's something weird about it. And we wound up going to the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, which is, you know, where Watson, you know, who discovered the double helix, had set up this incredible laboratory. And we went to a big fancy conference, and we met some of the first-rate scientists, including an individual named Eric Lander, who's now on our board, and he's one of one of President Obama's top science advisors. He runs the Eli Broad Institute now for medical genetics. He's a genius. And we showed him the data from this case, and he went, oh, my God, this is terrible. because they had not done the things that you needed to do to validate the technology. They didn't have a good matching rule. They hadn't done the population genetics. The whole thing was a mess. So we did this hearing in front of Judge Judy's husband, Jerry Scheinlin. And in the middle of the hearing, I mean, the people from LifeCodes were giving answers. You know, I remember at one point turning to him and I said, this guy just gave two contradictory answers under oath in 7 seconds. You know, in an ordinary courthouse, you'd put him in a jumpsuit. You go, oh, he's a scientist. He's a PhD. In the middle of the hearing. And they had on the other side a guy that won, Richard Roberts, who won a Nobel Prize for his work on restriction enzymes and everything. And the proof was so overwhelming that they hadn't done this right that Eric had a meeting with the prosecution's experts, and they signed a joint statement saying that this is not good. You're going to ruin an incredible technology. And both sides agreed and recommended that the National Academy of Science create a committee to do the proper validation for the transfer of this technology from medical and research purposes to forensic uses. And that happened. And then Eric wrote it up in Nature. And the next thing you knew, you know, Peter and I were like experts. You know, we were helping the police. We were helping the prosecutors. And we actually realized right away that this was going to be unbelievably transformative because it was going to be able to show that people who had been convicted were innocent, and it was going to be able to identify the person who really committed the crime. So now, 22 years later, we're up to 311 post-conviction DNA exonerations. In 146 cases, we found the person who really committed the crime. And I should hasten to add that our colleagues at the University of Michigan Law School and Northwestern have something called the Registry of Wrongful Convictions, because all the innocence projects except ours will do DNA and non-DNA cases. And since 1989, there are over 1,500 instances where people have had their convictions vacated, charges dismissed based on new evidence of innocence. And we're first just keeping track of them. We're finding more and more. So this system has always been riddled with error. And the incredible aspect of all of this is that DNA has shown us there were far more innocent people than you ever expected. And, you know, why should we be surprised? Because we don't pay the lawyers to represent the indigent, which is 90% of the people that come to court. The forensic science was never properly validated, whether it was fingerprints or bite mark evidence or tool marks on bullets or any of this. The eyewitness identification was not properly a single greatest cause of the conviction of the innocent, was not paying attention to a wonderful body of social science research over the last 30 years. False confessions are all over the place. And this has become a learning moment for the criminal justice system. So we are not just getting innocent people out of prison. We have a program of reforms that are really win-wins, public safety, that Democrats, Republicans.
We're going to talk more about that. But really, you know, hearing your story in the fullness of that story, you went from being the accidental expert to being the nexus of reform and exoneration for at least those 311 people, and also building a whole body of work on which so much of future cases will rest. And it keeps getting better, the best practices that you're trying to bring into it, as well as keeping a good handle on how many people are actually involved with all this. Clearly, this isn't exactly what you thought you were getting into in 1988.
You want to know the truth? We knew it.
We knew it
right away. You know, because we, you know, when you teach law and you've been in the system and following the psychology and so many other things, we knew how bad it was.
But so did a lot of people. But you made the difference. I mean, you decided to actually do something in a way.
Not just us. I mean, you have to understand, we have 51 projects in the United States. There are 6 abroad. There are people.
But not in 1988. I mean, at that point, I mean, it's one thing to know something, Barry. It's another thing to say, I'm going to act on it and do something.
Well, when you have people like Virginia and Mark, and you have all these incredible people across the country, you know, they make us look good, right? We may have had the original idea, but we just take credit for everything.
Can I add, David, that I think it's been good for forensic science in general, too, because the DNA technology is very powerful. But the original DNA, many of the original applications were very primitive. Essentially, they were things that people could, kits that people could buy and do them at home, essentially. And it was very important to make it much more rigorous and much more reliable. And it's very, because it is very powerful technology.
And to have standards.
To have standards.
And also exactly. To educate everyone that just because the technology existed as it did then in 1988 or, and years afterward, and even up until, you know, very recent times, that it keeps getting better. I'm thinking about the Jardine case that we talked about when you were here last time, almost 2 years ago.
Yes. And if at not that for point, the DNA, Alvin would still be in prison. He had 15 more years to go.
What is that? What do you have any contact with him now?
I do. Yes, I talk to him quite regularly. He's struggling, as you know. Hawaii is one of the states that has no compensation, which I think is a real shame. We have a victims' compensation fund, and a person who is wrongly convicted is just as much a victim as the person who was, you know, victimized in the original crime.
So it's just a case of where the state says, "Oh, gee, we're sorry."
Oh no, they don't say they're sorry. They haven't, at least so far. And, you know, when he was released, of course, the charges were not immediately dismissed. Hawaii doesn't have a mechanism where a judge can just say, "I declare you innocent." They can set aside the conviction.
And this is after this man has been incarcerated for 20 years.
Mm-hmm. He was 20 when he went in. He was 40 when he came out. His daughter was 20 when he came out. And they hadn't seen each other since she was 6 months old. So she didn't have any memory of him, because Hawaii ships many, if not most, of its prisoners to other states. And people who are not well off cannot afford to travel to the mainland. And most of the prisons are located quite some distance, even from any airport. So to get to the Saguaro facility, for example, you have to fly to Phoenix or Tucson and then drive for a couple of hours to get there. So it's very hard. It tears families apart, and they struggle even after they're released.
Tonight we're talking about the Hawaii Innocence Project, and we have the founder of the National Innocence Project joining us tonight. Barry Scheck is here, and so are you. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone lines are open, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Changing the judicial system so that this is a different kind of, well, I don't want to say kinder or gentler because that phrase has been overly used, but really in terms of just best practices, so that we don't have people winding up in jail for extended period of time for decades. And who know, they are innocent and are only waiting for someone to help them prove it. You have a lot of people contacting you, obviously. Once you started with that first case, and as you said, someone stood up and said, "Well, I got another case for you." There are a lot of people who in some way or other are looking for help, whether or not they meet your criteria. Specifically, what is it that you look for when you're sifting through all those cases and all the people who are contacting you?
Well, the Innocence Project in New York, we're still sticking just to DNA, although we work on policy initiatives with others in the network and, you know, lobbying in Washington, D.C. for funding for changing forensic science, things of that nature. But our test is a simple one. You know, you write to us, would a DNA test prove you're innocent? That's it. So that's very simple. The other projects in the network have it much more difficult time because they then have to evaluate cases of people who are saying, "I'm innocent, I'm innocent." And there may be a little DNA, it won't be definitive, but they have to look at all kinds of other new evidence to see whether or not there's been a miscarriage of justice. And those cases are obviously harder to evaluate and they take more time to vet.
If you're just joining us tonight on Town Square, we're talking about the Innocence Project, both the Hawaii Innocence Project and the National Project with co-founder Barry Scheck, who is here. If you have had an experience here or elsewhere with the Innocence Project or wish you could, and you feel like sharing your story, we'd like to hear from you. 941-3689. We realize it's a sensitive topic, but if you would like to talk to us about it, We'd like to talk to you too. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Imagine being in prison for decades, knowing you're innocent, and hoping that someone will be able to help you prove it. DNA testing has been able to do that. The technology continues to evolve. In some cases, the confluence of developing technology and evidence that was kept or saved as it was in the Jardine case can mean that someone can go free. 941-3689 is our number, or 877-941-3689. We say this word technology as if it's all embracing, Dave, and somehow, well, technology will fix it, or we'll know what to do with it because, you know, technology will give us the answers. But very clearly, in this case, as it's been developing over time, it's only as good as wherever it is, and that may not be good enough, as it wasn't in the Jardine case until it was good enough for something to happen. How would you characterize the state of DNA testing now?
Well, it's certainly much better than it was in the past. As Barry pointed out, some of the early testing, it was very primitive and not very well done. It's gotten much more rigorous. But also the technology is continuing to improve. And I really think that the legal system has to be willing to take advantage of the tremendous advances in technology that have taken place. There's so much emphasis now on human genetics in identifying disease-causing genes and looking at human variation. There's an incredibly rich resource out there for human identification at the level of DNA. And the existing technology really has to catch up with that in the legal system. And there's a ways to go to achieve that.
Which is in part, Barry, what you've been working on as well with reform. But from very high-tech standpoint, talking about technology, to something, I don't want to call it as simple because that seems to demean it, but the idea of an eyewitness. We have this idea that seems to persist that if you have an eyewitness account, that's definitive, and that we all believe somehow that we know what we know, and that's just the end of it. And yet, clearly, we all have examples in our lives where we thought we saw something in a certain place, or we thought that we saw somebody in a certain place, and then we come to find out it didn't happen that way at all. And as you mentioned earlier, there's a whole body of evidence coming through the psychological community that, you know, we do mistake a whole lot. How come we haven't been able to have the legal system catch up with knowledge we've had for years?
It's been hard, but they are beginning to catch up now. We have 13 states at the moment that are employing best practices to do eyewitness identification procedures. And, you know, you can do it in a low-tech way. And by the way, you can do it in a high-tech way. But it's pretty simple in some respects. You're going to show people a photo array, right? It's best to probably show them one at a time, pictures one at a time in sequence. You will tell the witness right away, I'm going to show you a series of photographs, or I'm going to show you a lineup of people. The real perpetrator may not be there. If you don't see the person, that committed this crime or that, you know, did this to you, don't worry. The investigation will continue. Now, we've known for 26 years that just giving that warning reduces false picks by 20%.
And the stress of the person who's trying to do it.
But, it's a very simple warning, but it's based on meta-analyses, work in the laboratory, because this is one area where you can actually do great experimental psychology, because each identification procedure is another, you know, memory experiment. And so you can do a lot in the lab with that, and we're doing some field studies now. So you give them a warning, the real perpetrator may not be there. The most important thing is that the person who is doing the experiment should not know the identity of the suspect.
So no subtle cues.
Right. I'll give you a very simple one. Thomas McGowan did 23 years in Fort Worth, Texas. He was walking down the street. He met a description of a woman who had been brutally raped. Somebody had broken into her home for an hour, right? Thought she had a good opportunity to view this individual. The officer thought that he met the description. He set up a lineup. The victim comes in and she says, you know, I think it's number two. And with very, very good intentions, the officer said, well, you have to be sure. And so she said, OK, yes, it is number two. because he was really saying, I can't arrest you, somebody, for something this serious if you're not really sure. Well, just think of it. If the officer had been blind, right, if he didn't know who the suspect was, when she said, I think it's number two, he never would have said, well-meaning though he was, are you sure? Which was perceived by the witness as being a cue. Yeah, that's the guy, you know, because you couldn't, no matter who you are, you can't be neutral, right? And it was a suggestion. He would never say that because it could be a filler. Number two could be somebody that we know didn't commit the crime. So if you're blinded, you would never do that. What's incredible is that Thomas was exonerated. We got a hit to the real perpetrator. That officer has now going across the country, helping us proselytize other colleagues and police forces saying, you've got to follow these best practices. The International Association of Chiefs of Police is recommending these practices, and state after state, that's being recommended. So, you know, you have to take a certainty statement in the words of the witness at the time of the identification. Certainty of a witness is the least reliable factor in terms of anything that you evaluate. But that is not done. And in fact, they take certainty statements, you know, that's the man in court, which is inversely correlated with reliability.
We're going to talk some more about this. I want to get some of our callers in. If you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open at 941-3689. If you call us from Oahu, that's the number to use. And from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. Going to George calling us from Maui. Aloha, George. Welcome to Town Square, and thank you for your patience.
Certainly. It's a very interesting subject you have here. And I just wanted to state that I was in prison with Al, and he was, you know, notoriously prone to being thrown in detention because he was so angry about the situation, you know. And over the period of time, it just wears on you. And he wasn't a bad guy. And he just kept swearing, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. I didn't do it. And,
well, that is that's sort of the ultimate nightmare for someone who knows that he or she is innocent. And then what happens? Where does all of that anger go?
Exactly.
Sometimes it's going to land you in solitary. George, thanks so much for calling, and we appreciate the fact that you told us a little something about yourself, too.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much. What would you do if you had a family member, or perhaps you even knew yourself, you were innocent and suddenly you found yourself serving time for a crime you knew that you didn't commit? Part of why the Innocence Project exists is so that hopefully that won't happen. They've exonerated 311 people in the last almost 22 years of its existence. Tonight on Town Square, we have the co-founder, Barry Scheck, here, also the director of the Hawaii Innocence Project, Professor Ginny Hench, and with us, geneticist Dave Hamer, also a UH professor. And you, too. You know, we all think that somehow technology is going to save us. In this case, it has saved a lot of people. The question is, how do we keep this moving forward, and how do we keep it from getting to this point in the first place? You've done sort of, you know, the back end of it, Barry, because that's where it started, you know, trying to prove that people who had been convicted weren't guilty of the crime. But on the front end, do we need to do some much better work now on the front end, as you've been talking about best practices with eyewitnesses, with pictures, not having the person who is showing a picture know what's going on, or someone who's there with the lineup, having the pictures be consistent so they're not different types of photographs but all the same kind of photo. Kind of real basic things like that that perhaps we didn't need to have the DNA testing way back when to be able to do. So it seems that a lot of these things are being driven by the fact that DNA testing could prove right or wrong, and that perhaps policemen don't want to be found in an embarrassing situation by not having done their jobs well. Is that playing with them, too?
Yes, I think that, police officers go in, you know, quite idealistically, and they want to get the right guy. And they know better than anybody when you show photos to somebody and they pick a filler, you know, that doesn't mean the witness is a bad witness. It, you know, actually, it means that probably the real perpetrator looks a lot like that filler, and you just had the wrong suspect in the photo array. But, you know, what's happening now, there was a 2009 report by the National Academy of Sciences that we were able to help get, where they looked at all the other forensic disciplines. And this is the leading scientific body in the United States, maybe the world. And they said, you know what? When we look at fingerprints, and people used to come into court and say, this fingerprint comes from that individual to the exclusion of everyone in the universe. And they weren't talking about 10 prints. They're talking about a partial latent on a surface that may have bumps. Because, you know, if you put your thumbprint down 40 times, it's going to look slightly different all 40 times, even on a flat surface. So they looked at fingerprints and they realized, oh, my God, they don't have a database. They've not validated it. There is a problem here, and it's more than a simple problem. You know, we had a situation where there was this lawyer in Portland, Oregon named Brandon Mayfield, and when those trains blew up in Madrid, they found a partial latent on blue plastic for the bomb that, you know, the Al-Qaeda used to blow up the trains in Madrid. And they put it into the automatic fingerprint identification system, which spits out, you know, candidate fingerprints for people to look at. And the FBI looks at 20 prints, and they look at the print from the blue plastic, and they say, aha, it belongs to this guy, who turns out to be Mayfield, whose prints were only in there because he was in the military. He's a lawyer in Portland. But talk about observer bias. They realized that he had converted to becoming a Muslim, and he had married a Muslim woman there. So they're convinced this must be the guy. They pick him up on a material witness order. They use the Patriot Act to do a sneak and peek of his home. He hires a federal defender. You know, a federal defender gets a fingerprint expert. The fingerprint expert looks at it and goes, it's Mayfield, 16-point match. Is there anything more certain? The Spanish authorities are looking at the same print. They're going, it's not him. We see these discrepancies. The FBI says, no, those are artifacts that happen when it, you know, gets rolled. Well, eventually, you never heard of this.
No, it is. But I mean, it's unbelievable to think that the quest for getting the right guy and taking, in some cases, racial or cultural profiling to do it and just wanting to have it case closed means that we close our minds to being able to see what other people are really seeing.
Right. Tunnel vision.
And they, what actually happened here, which is extraordinary, is that eventually the Spanish authorities found the real guy. And everybody agreed it was that other individual's print. Mayfield is let out of jail. So the first report from their internal quality assurance people, from Phil Stacey, he says, you know what the problem here is? The FBI fingerprint analyst was taking a look at the latent, and he made a bad call, and there were two other guys there looking at it, and they just went along with the boss. So therefore, when you have a kind of subjective forensic assay like this, and it's a high-profile case, there's a greater chance of error. Okay, pretty scary, right? Then the inspector general looks at it and says, no, that's not the problem. And the reason that's not the problem is that among all the prints – the one that most resembled the print on the blue plastic was Mayfield's, right? And that doesn't explain the defense expert also looking at the print and thinking it's Mayfield's, right? So how do you explain that? And so they realize that there's something awry with the way they go about doing fingerprints, nor can they tell you what the probative value of that association is. It's not uniqueness. You know, it's something that they have to determine statistically and quantify. So what the FBI is doing now, and this is a very good thing, is that at least in terms of the cognitive science, the observer bias, every time they take a fingerprint, a latent, they'll look at the latent print and they will score it for all the, you know, the minutiae and whorls they see. Anything that looks like it's a potential artifact, they have to score as a quote-unquote red flag. Then and only then will they look at the target prints. And then if they change their mind after looking at the target print, they have to document that.
So in essence, they're doing a blind look at it too.
Exactly.
And not being influenced by bias, whether or not they're realizing it.
That's right. And this is all cognitive science. This is all, by the way, cutting-edge cognitive science. The problem is that other than the FBI, I doubt that there's more than three or four laboratories in the United States that are doing it that way. Now, the Innocence Project and the FBI have had a lot of alliances now. They're doing that on fingerprints. They agreed that composite bullet lead analysis was wrong. They sent out letters all across the country saying our examiners were wrong. Look at these cases again. They just sent out a letter. This happened 2 weeks ago. That their own examiners had been exaggerating the probative value of microscopic hair comparisons. So they've sent out, they're going to send out like 23,000 letters, essentially. They're going to review 23,000 cases, and they've already sent out 20-something letters, and there'll be more, saying, we've looked at the testimony of these analysts, and it's exceeded the limits of science. That doesn't mean that the person is innocent, but let's see if we can find the hair and do a mitochondrial DNA test on that hair. Now, this is extraordinary that the FBI is doing it. It's terrific. And, you know, it's going to be true of the hair examinations, I'm sure, in Hawaii and all across the country, that the state people probably made the same kind of exaggerations. So what the National Academy of Science did in this report and what is happening now is that they're establishing a National Commission on Forensic Science. But even more important, the Department of Justice has agreed that the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which is the federal agency filled with first-rate scientists who, you know, will come up with the tensile strength of beams, they said all the weights and measures, right? Bulletproof vests. They are going to be looking at all these different technologies, working with the National Science Foundation, doing basic and applied research. And whatever the NIST says is the way to interpret a fingerprint or tool marks on a bullet, it's not going to be any more people coming into court saying this bullet comes from that gun to the exclusion of all guns in the universe. Whatever NIST says, as far as federal laboratories are concerned, our Department of Justice is going to say, okay, we'll abide by that. We're not the scientists. And, you know, there'll be things like bite marks that will probably never be validated. This is a very, very big deal. And it's not just going to protect the innocent. It's going to catch guilty people. And it's also going to protect our national security.
And it may cost less in real dollars.
Well, absolutely. In the end, I mean, yes. The cost of these 311 wrongful convictions, 146 real perpetrators identified, you know how many crimes these people committed, you know, hundreds while the wrong person was in prison, and what the cost to a whole range of victims are. We wish we could calculate it more accurately. And then some of these people do file lawsuits, and it costs millions of dollars.
Which means there's a good reason for trying to do it right instead of just doing what is easy.
Everyone.
Exactly.
Can I just add that I'm glad that same report from the National Academy of Sciences did laud DNA technology as an example of what the rest of the forensic sciences need to be brought up to. And that's a very good thing. But I would suggest, though, that the DNA technology can continue to be improved. And there are a number of areas where we have to do better than we are doing, especially as far as DNA works really well as far as excluding a suspect. But the inclusion of a suspect, especially you talk about databases, we still have a lot of things to look at to make that better, that technology better.
Give me an example. Oh, go ahead, Jenny, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, Dave, if you would talk a little bit about what you've talked about to some of the Hawaii Innocence Project student volunteers about the populations and the sampling that goes into calculating.
Yeah, well, the likelihood estimates of something belonging to a particular individual is based entirely on someone's ethnicity. And ethnicity is a very difficult thing to define, especially here in Hawaii. We have all these people and they're that are mixed ethnicity. People are proud of having mixed ethnicity here. So then when you want to make these likelihood calculations, which ethnic database do you choose? Because we don't have the right database a lot of times. And when you look at Native American groups, the American Indian groups, they're very, very unusual in terms of their population makeup. They're very unusual. And you cannot compare one group, an individual from one group to an individual from another. So there's a lot of work to be done. Although, again, I certainly believe the DNA technology is very powerful. There's a lot we need to continue to improve on.
I think
Dave, having said that, though, for the fact that here we are in Hawaii and we know how our populations mix and that we have a very unlikely a situation where you can find exactly a match in exactly the same way that you just talked about if you only are looking in one part of someone's ethnicity as opposed to all of it together.
Yes,
doesn't that
right.
mean that we need to have a much better database right here and this is work that Hawaii and only Hawaii needs to do in this way?
Well, it needs to be done all over the country. I mean, Hawaii, it's very important for Hawaii, but it's not unique to Hawaii. It needs to be done all over the country. For example, some of the databases we have, one of the databases is called African American. One is called Hispanic. And, you know, a Hispanic from one part of the world is very different, potentially
right.
very
I mean,
different.
These aren't purist situations.
They're not pure. They're not well-defined.
We aren't purist.
That's right. Yes.
I think actually the biggest problem, though, beyond these this problem of population substructure that Dave's talking about, is that the technology has gotten so good in being able to amplify very, very small amounts of DNA that it's very hard to deal with mixtures. And if you have DNA from more than one source and you're amplifying it from a very, very what they call low template DNA, a small amount of starting material, it becomes very complicated first to explain to people what the odds are that somebody might or might not be a contributor to the mixture. And there's also a lot of problems even in the way they do the tests when you're dealing at low level. There's something called, I don't want to get too crazy about this, stochastic fluctuation and contamination. But, you know, DNA is the best thing we have, but it can be abused and it can be misused and the labs have to do it right. Mm-hmm. And we have to be careful about it.
And doesn't that also mean that there has to be a certain level and standards of practice to which all ascribe and which you have someone playing watchdog?
Absolutely.
And there is. Well, by and large, there is that for the labs that are certified to do DNA testing. There are very rigorous standards that they have to meet. But still, you have to watch. You have to watch out and make sure that it's done. That
so who's the watchdog?
There's a national
DNA advisory board.
There's an advisory board, and there are certification programs. The American Blood Bank Association has probably the premier certification. So if you have the work done by a laboratory that has this certification from these national organizations, you can count on it to be very reliable.
But I do think there are problems because you push this technology too far with small amounts of starting material and mixtures. You're asking for trouble.
Yes.
Well, right now we're asking if you have some real fear coursing through you as you think about this, or does this give you great hope? How do you assess DNA testing now after hearing some of the conversation that we've had tonight? If you're just joining us, we are talking about the Hawaii Innocence Project and the national project started by Barry Scheck 22 years ago, actually co-founded. We won't give Peter Neufeld a problem here.
No.
He was in here too, colleagues and friends and all. But
he's envious I'm here in Hawaii.
Well, he'll have to come back and talk to us too. The point being, as you listen to all of this and we put great faith in stock by what DNA technology can and can't do, and just in the best practices of what we hope law enforcement does, and yet we know that there's a lot that they don't do, how do we begin to really shift mindsets and push toward better practices, the best practices for the really simple stuff, not just all the DNA and fancy testing that we can have, but really the simple stuff from the get-go. How do you feel about all this? 941-3689, if you're calling us from Oahu, that's the number, 941-3689. If you're on the Neighbor Islands or listening to the live stream, we want to hear from you, too. You guys have been awfully quiet tonight. Don't know whether this is like too much to take in or you're sitting there sort of hunkering down in a little fear thinking, oh, boy. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Dave Hamer.
Going back to the Jardine case, though, on the upside, I want to say that it was very gratifying to me to listen to the judge. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the brief you filed was 140 pages
something
long.
Like that, yeah.
And it was full of, questions about eyewitness testimony, but the judge clearly said the DNA evidence was the most compelling information to exclude, to realize that the wrong person was in jail. And that was very gratifying to hear that, because the DNA should be objective. That's the way it should be.
He also noted that the eyewitness evidence, the expert testimony from Elizabeth Loftus, would be highly relevant if there were a retrial. But he based his decision to vacate the conviction on the DNA evidence.
Well, you know, I think that focusing on this eyewitness identification, you know, we now have two landmark decisions, one in New Jersey called State versus Henderson and another one in Oregon, Oregon versus Lawson, where the courts have taken notice of this 30 years of great experimental psychology research, and they're going to give charges to juries that are completely different than anything we've had before. Things like, you know, weapon focus can increase the risk of misidentification. If you have first you look at a mugshot and then you look at somebody in a lineup, that if you identified somebody in the mugshot, the chances that you'll pick them out in the lineup are very high, even if you made a mistake in the first instance.
And because you've already seen that person
right once,
and it may or may not be the person who actually committed the crime. It's just something that your brain is remembering.
And right. And then, of course, cross-racial identification is problematic. And we find that whether you're a white person living in a majoritarian black culture in Africa or, you know, in Asia, people from different races are just not as good at identifying each other by face as people within the same race. And that is a factor that juries have to be instructed. And actually, that's probably something that there's a lot of neuroscience now going on that really informs much of the experimental psychology. I don't know if you saw an article in the Times this week about it's actually an article in Nature, in Science magazine, about the ability to using optogenetics to create a false memory in a mouse. We are learning so much now about the brain. I mean, the 21st century is a century of
Inception
the brain.
Is no joke.
No joke.
And that should probably scare the pants off of you, too. 941-3689 is our number, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We've had some people call who want to talk about this, but they don't want to go on the air. If you have a question and you're a shy caller, that's okay, too. Just give David your question briefly, and we will pass it through. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. I mean, in some ways, Barry, Ginny, and certainly Dave, you know, this is getting scarier and scarier, as well as the flip side of it, making it more definitive in how we're able to assess guilt or innocence, and also what we should be doing at the very beginning of an investigation, which also kind of brings us to the point about, well, what about simple things like videotaping?
Well, videotaping of interrogations is extremely important because that is the best record you can have. And the problem of false confessions arises in close to 20% of our cases. And I really would commend everybody to take a look at the movie The Central Park Five, which is about the jogger case in New York that Sarah and Ken Burns did. You know, and, you know, there are five young men who were convicted of a crime that was committed by one man who wrote us a letter, Matthias Reyes, who was actually attacking women and murdered a few and had raped another one in Central Park before he attacked the jogger just 2 days before. And all, you know, all these kids were brought in. They were interrogated. And then after they'd been tuned up for, you know, many, many hours, then they put them on tape. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget looking at that. As a commentator for Court TV, they got it early. And, you know, Steve Brill says, take a look at these videotapes. They're, you know, they show no remorse. Well, of course they showed no remorse. They were innocent. And, you know, when you get to know these young men, and then in the movie you really get a sense of them. They're really remarkable people. But in Chicago last year, there were two other cases where we had DNA exonerations involving five young African Americans, some of whom gave false confessions, other of whom pled guilty to crimes they didn't commit. And in both of those instances, there was another serial rapist murderer who committed, you know, with two of them, right, committed one crime that five were convicted of, another crime that five were convicted of. So this problem of false confessions, it's so powerful. If you're looking at fingerprints, right, and you're a fingerprint examiner, and we tell you that you're looking at a case and it involves a a confession, then you will wind up matching people that shouldn't That's be right. matched because you think there's a confession.
Well, because you want to have some sense of closure. I mean, we all seem to have this drive to want to tie it up with a neat little blue ribbon and say, here it is.
It's contextual bias. It's cognitive bias. Mm-hmm. And we are learning more and more about cognitive bias, and it's extremely powerful. It affects the way that you read a DNA result. You should be blinded when you look at these DNA results on charts, just as when you look at fingerprints, just as in so many other areas. And just in terms of conducting investigations, we know that there's a phenomenon known as tunnel vision, confirmation bias, selection bias. We're learning so much about this, and we have to totally revamp the way that we go about investigations and the way we go about evaluating evidence.
I mean, in essence, we see what we want to see. We've known that anecdotally for a very, very long time. We just haven't applied it in very strict and rigorous ways.
Now it's being getting done rigorously.
Exactly, to what we see happening when it comes to law enforcement. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Phones are now lighting up, so do give us a call, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We're talking about the Innocence Project, DNA evidence, where we are now, some scary stuff about what you think you know when, in fact, you may or may not know it. You may simply just have a bias of which you are unaware. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Dave, calling us from Waimea. Aloha, Dave.
Aloha. I've got a question, maybe a little unusual because I'm going to the other side of the coin. But what's to stop somebody from packaging and bringing DNA evidence of somebody else to a crime and then making sure that they just don't leave any of their own DNA there, and then they leave the crime, and now you've got somebody who's accused, who maybe is good for it, maybe has a criminal record, and the DNA does match, and everybody's happy to cart the guy away and put him in jail?
Well, you know, anything is possible. Actually, people forget, you know, that was really the plot of Scott Turow's novel and movie Presumed Innocent.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
I mean, the point is, if somebody really is hell-bent on framing someone, this could happen. It's not something that you can say irrevocably, no, we won't ever see that.
Right. Well,
but would they look at the possibility? I guess that's what I'm asking, because if they're not willing to even look at that possibility, there could be a problem.
Well, that's the whole point. So do they leave the mind open a little bit that some of this might not be as good, even as conclusive as it may be?
Oh, yeah. I mean, what law enforcement is all about these days is trying to figure out what is the origin or the probative value of pieces of biology found at crime scenes. You know, we're making cases all the time based on, you know, skin cells that are found on a piece of clothing that's found at a crime scene, a cigarette butt that has saliva in it. There's even, and this is where the problem of low template DNA comes in, there's something that's a misnomer called touch DNA. Mm-hmm. If you touch a garment, we can make cuttings of that and then amplify it up. And if there's a mixture there, what do you do with it? There's all kinds of things that can happen. But, you know, it was always true. I could, you know, how many movies have you seen where they took somebody's hand and they had them grasp the gun so the fingerprints would be on the gun and then threw it, you know, to...
Or make sure that, you know, somebody's eyeball was scanned. I mean, those have been in so many films and books that, yeah, we have a lot of imagination when it comes to that. The question is, how do you separate that sort of imaginative what if with the reality of it? And that's what you're saying, is that we're getting to that point where we're able to do it better and better, but we need to make it consistent.
The people that are in our movement, like Dr. William Thompson, who's a psychologist and a lawyer, right, who's worked on DNA and other forensic issues, he's got a contract now with the Department of Defense to assist in trying to figure out how we made mistakes looking for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, right? I mean, there really is an effort going on to figure out how these cognitive biases, these tunnel visions, selection bias, confirmation bias, really affects things. I mean, one of the key things about this innocence movement is we're forming in prosecutors' offices what we call conviction integrity units. And these are trying to get somebody in the prosecutor's office who will come to, you know, Innocence Projects when they say, this is a case. Let's say there's no DNA. It may be a miscarriage of justice. Will you look at this? Let's look at it together. I'll show you my file, the defense lawyer, you know, file. I'll show you all these witnesses. You show me post-conviction, everything in your file. Why not? Right? There's a witness. Before we're going to go in, we could have gone out and interviewed that witness ourselves. But we know that if you go interview that witness first and maybe let our investigator tag along and you do the initial questioning, that you'll feel if the witness gives exculpatory statements to our client has been convicted, you'll take greater ownership of that. And then you figure out a way to conduct a post-conviction investigation in a non-adversarial manner as a search for the truth. This is a completely different concept than anything we've had in our adversary system. In fact, we now have ethics rules that say that if you're a prosecutor and you discover post-conviction what they call material, very important evidence, or you find evidence that's clear and convincing that somebody is innocent, you've got to do something about it. Now, the Constitution doesn't say anything like that, not yet, but the ethics rules do. And this is a profound shift. It really makes a big difference.
We had a caller on the line who unfortunately was on a cellular phone with only a few bars, and sometimes that happens. But the question is, where are we now as you look at the United States and this movement moving and growing? What percentage of law enforcement actually is on board and doing this now?
Well, I think we have about 20 states that are videotaping interrogations. We have 13 that are doing eyewitness reform. I was down visiting with some chiefs at the Honolulu Police Department yesterday, and they're, I think, looking at some very good best practices to adopt. We're hopeful that the Hawaii Supreme Court will take a look at the Henderson decision and the Lawson decision and adopt that those new rules for the assessment and evaluation of eyewitness evidence. We hope psychologists, really get involved in evaluating. They do a pretty good job in Honolulu here of videotaping interrogations, but we need psychologists to work with the police department on how you do the interrogations. How do you evaluate it? You know, with the confessions, the best trained interrogators are those that do not inadvertently ask leading questions and reveal information that only the perpetrator and the investigator should know. What you want to do in an interrogation is make sure that the suspect is the one that gives information that only the perpetrator and the police would know, and anything that the suspect says leads to new incriminating information. That's a test of reliability. That's not the law, unfortunately, yet. The law is, did you coerce them? That's not a good enough a way to look at it.
That's
we should
a little
be looking
different
at reliability.
Because
yes.
Coercion means that you are cognizant of your coercion. You know what you're doing. But what you're talking about is just simply knowing what you know and trying not to, in a way, give the right answer, whatever you think that right answer is. And yet, because of your own bias, because of the fact that it exists, we are human, it's going to happen. So then what would be the fix for that? Simply having someone who is running the interrogation have a list of questions, not know any of the answers?
Well, no. The fix is, number one, you have to videotape the interrogation so we have a good record of exactly
starting
what was said.
Starting at the beginning, not just afterwards.
From the beginning, from the time of Miranda warnings in a place of detention. That's number one. Number two, you know, psychologists, you know, should be working with police officials to train people to do interrogations correctly.
Yes.
Because that is the way that you – it's an art. It's a science, I should say, of how you get information from people and you test their memories and you test their credibility without inadvertently feeding them facts and getting from them information that will increase your belief that they're reliable. You know, the British have a completely different approach to this. They have something they call the peace method. And they're not looking – I was at a American Psychology and Law Conference in Portland a few months ago, and one of the lead interrogators in United Kingdom said, we don't have any false confessions. He said, why not? He says, well, we don't get confessions. We just get the suspects to give us false exculpatory statements, which can be very – persuasive proof.
Right.
So, you know, there's lots of different – you have to prepare for these interrogations. We really have to work with police officials in training them to do this right. Mm-hmm. And there is so much to be learned from, you know, psychologists and cognitive science. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's a great myth is that a trained police officer in just looking at somebody giving a statement is better at detecting deception than anybody else. It's been tested again and again and again and again, and they're
it's
not
false.
Better. Yeah. You know, good liars will deceive anybody.
Well, that's the point of the fact of your, when you're trying to just gather information, not trying to go in there and presume something.
Exactly.
That's the bottom line. You simply have to go in there and gather information. And if you don't know what the answers really are, you're there simply to gather, then there's no way really that you can lead someone down a path or not another. But that seems so very simple in a way, but it's taken such a long time for law enforcement and psychology to begin to coalesce. And the confluence of what can happen with both is where you'd like to see our judicial system go.
Exactly.
One more thing I want to ask you, because we talked about the Jardine case.
Yes.
Before you leave, what cases, are there cases that you can talk about now that you're currently working on that will strike us as profoundly as the Jardine case did?
Well, we have several cases that we've been working on for as long as we've been working on the Jardine case, and they're not to the point where I can actually discuss them yet. But
when you can, you'll come back and
I certainly
we'll find
yes.
out more, which means to say there's more for you to do. How many requests do you get now?
We get quite a few. Of course, we're a small state, but we have a fairly large prison population for the size of our state, and we get a lot of inquiries. And the only cases that we take, we don't limit our caseload to DNA, but we only take cases in which the person has a claim that they were not the right person or that no crime actually occurred at all. That might be like an arson case or something like that, where perhaps there have been exonerations in other states where an accidental fire was deemed to be an arson based on faulty science, and someone was convicted of murder because someone died in the fire. So we don't have an arson case at present, but that would be an example of there was no crime type of case.
He asked a very simple question. Would DNA evidence prove you innocent? Innocent. Is that a question you also simply ask and just use that as your litmus test?
No, it's not as simple as that for us, because first of all, only about 10% of all cases have DNA.
Right.
So that's why he severely limits the cases that are coming to
you. But they take cases from all over the country, and we only right. take cases where the person's convicted in Hawaii.
Yeah, really the idea is how similar are the requests and the way in which you judge them. We're coming down to the very last 45 seconds of the show. Very quickly, a final word from you, Dave, in terms of DNA technology and how much faith to put in it.
It's very good, but it could be better.
Ginny?
Well, I just would like to see some reforms so that we can prevent as well as cure wrongful convictions.
The prevention would be a very good thing. And Barry, I'll give you the final word.
Well, I'm hopeful that the Hawaiian courts and the police or prosecutors and defense are all going to get together and adopt the best practices to protect the innocent and enhance capability of law enforcement to find the real perpetrators.
Meanwhile, we'll be checking with all of you to find out how the cases are going, when you can talk about them. Barry Scheck, thank you so much for coming in. Ginny Hensch
and
Dave Hamer, and you too for joining us for Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. I'll see you tomorrow morning on The Conversation. Aloha.